Welcome to Software Gone Wild. Today, yet again, talking about a network automation tool. But it is more than network automation, as you'll see during this talk. It's a tool with an interesting history. It started as an open source project, and then it was acquired by a large networking vendor. Well, the company was acquired by a large networking vendor. And that networking vendor is now going to be acquired by another ASIC manufacturer. And who knows what will happen next. It might be turtles all the way down. So by now, you probably know what I'm talking about. We'll be talking about StackStorm. And with me are two Matts. Matt Stone, that was last on this podcast in episode 13 in October of 2014. And Matt Oswald, who's a regular guest, so I guess you will all recognize his voice. And of course, we have Eliza Yashinska to ask the intelligent questions, because I'll just ask the stupid ones. So, Matt and Matt, how are you guys doing?
I'm good. Man, I can't believe it's been that long since the last time I was on this podcast.
I checked.
Time flies, huh?
I absolutely understand, and I sympathize with that, because it has been a long 3 months for me as well.
But we're good. I mean, I'm good, at least. I won't speak for Oswald, but I mean, things have been going well. I mean, I've been at Brocade now a little over a year and a half, I think, and made my full transition to be a software developer. And so work for the StackStorm team now as a core developer. And yeah, things are good.
So the last time we chatted, you were just bringing up your data center network with Cumulus Linux. Mm-hmm. What happened in the meantime the last 2 years?
Well, I was part of a startup then that ended up folding. And so at that point, I went to Brocade. I actually had a few different offers on the table whenever I transitioned into Brocade. And the appealing thing for coming here was the ability to kind of live in two worlds, so to speak, when I first came here. So when I first came here, I was working with Mike Bouchong on the product management side. And so basically, I had an opportunity to kind of rapidly prototype some software stuff. So like PyNOS was one of the things that I initiated. And there's some other stuff that we did internally that resulted in us deciding to go out and acquire StackStorm. And so once we acquired them, I requested to be moved to their team full time. And so kind of the rest is history, so to speak, from that regard.
The other Matt, the last time we spoke, you were at eBay, right?
Yeah, that's right. And sort of similar story. You know, I spent probably the last, you know, year and a half, pushing 2 years, focused on software development within an enterprise context at eBay, doing network automation and really all kinds of tooling involved there, both short-term and long-term things. But, you know, I had these ideas of automation and some of the fundamental concepts that I thought of as being fundamental to a successful automation deployment. And so when I started looking for a new, you know, a new position, I started looking at companies that might align with those ideas, and StackStorm really fit the bill. I actually was really lucky to find StackStorm, considering that I had the ideals first, and then was fortunate enough to meet a company that met a good chunk of them. So yeah, it's been cool. I mean, it's only been 2.5 weeks for me, so take that with a grain of salt. But I think it's going well so far. The team's amazing, you know, except for Matt. Matt's, you know, okay.
Well, you know.
But
yeah, we both met Matt, so okay. Let's move on. Oh, Matt is super awesome, so he's not just amazing.
Sure.
Let's put it this way.
I like how you chose to say Matt there, because we don't really know which one you're talking about.
That's up to you to decide, guys. I'm not going there. This whole idea of this podcast started with Matt O publishing a blog post about principles of network automation. So shall we start there, Matt, or shall we start with what StackStorm is all about?
We can start with maybe some of the fundamentals and just sort of briefly go over those. And that way people sort of understand, at least from my perspective, because those are basically, that blog post was me documenting the ideas that I'd had for the last, you know, five to eight months or so, and then matching those with StackStorm. So I think you maybe spend 5 to 7 minutes on those at a high level. We could, of course, return to those afterwards and maybe dive a little deeper. But just to set the stage for, you know, how StackStorm fits into that, those ideals, I think would be cool.
Okay, so let's do it.
The blog post, basically, you know, it's real simple. I called it, you know, like the fundamentals of automation. And these are three concepts that I came up with that I felt were indicative of mature automation deployments. These are principles that folks that really understood automation and the value that it was going to bring to their environment, things that they shared in common. And these are things that I observed both in, you know, some things I observed in my own organization, some things I observed in some of my extracurricular activities, things that I observed from other companies. These are sort of like the three common threads that I observed. I condense these to three rules. The first rule is the rule of algorithmic thinking. This is the idea that everything is a system. Everything you do, say, or smell is part of a system, whether you think it is or not. And I use the example as the water cycle. It's a really simple example. The water cycle is something that we participate in, whether we think we do or not. And technology is very much the same way. If you want to have success in the world of automation, it's best to have the mindset of thinking of things as a system and being able to compartmentalize things in a very specific way. It really demystifies and takes the magic out of automation, because when you have this mindset, you start thinking of things in very isolated, very pragmatic ways. I have this component that does a very specific thing. Let's make sure that that's well optimized so that the system as a whole can work. So this algorithmic way of thinking is really all about understanding that everything is a system, being able to look at things from a big picture perspective, but also being able to go down to the nitty gritty when needed. Next rule is the rule of bottlenecks. I observed this when I started understanding things about organizational culture, because there are many cultural aspects to this as well. Being able to identify bottlenecks are a really important facet of, you know, automation design, because there's always going to be a bottleneck somewhere. It's just the nature of bottlenecks. That's why bottlenecks are a thing. And so the rule of bottlenecks basically states, look, bottlenecks are going to be somewhere. What you as the designer of a system need to understand is the place where that bottleneck is right now, is that worth addressing or is it not worth addressing? Because you may have optimized an automation system well enough that, yes, there's going to be a bottleneck, but it's not actually holding you back from achieving your business objectives. And so it may not be worth addressing. A good example is, you know, a programmer that might spend an inordinate amount of time on optimizing a function, you know, shaving milliseconds off its runtime when that function really only runs every 30 minutes or so. You know, that's not really saving anybody any time. And so being able to think, it's kind of back to the first rule a little bit as well. Being able to have that big picture perspective and understanding what the actual bottleneck is really, really useful.
One to pull from the Phoenix Project a little bit on that too, they give the example of the kind of, you know, system of a factory and how one thing moves to the other. And basically, if you start optimizing software in a place that's not actually the constraint, well, maybe you've made a system faster, which only actually ends up overloading the actual bottleneck even more. And so I think solving the right problem is kind of at the heart of the rule of bottlenecks, like making sure that you know exactly what constraints you are working within and making sure that you're focusing on the right thing.
Yeah, it's really all about like root cause analysis.
Right.
Like, what is the real problem?
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, they tend to see a problem and think that it's the root cause, but it ends up actually just being a symptom.
Mm.
So that's a good skill to have.
Yeah, and for the listeners, the Phoenix Project is a book that everyone in IT should, well, must, RFC 2119 must read, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the Phoenix Project, I think, has long been considered one of the de facto standards as far as thinking through kind of DevOps type concepts and stuff. But it also, I think, it paints a really realistic picture of what a normal information technology shop would meet as far as the not only the cultural kind of issues that you'll run into, but also some of the kind of technology issues and things that typically crop up. And so it's a fictional book based on, I mean, I'm not going to, you know, maybe this is a little short ad for it, but it's a fictional book that basically follows a guy's journey through making his company successful. There's some really interesting problems. But yeah, I mean, it paints a really good picture of some of these ideals that we're talking about.
And then you had the third principle, right?
Yeah, right. The third rule is the rule of autonomy. This one's one that I'm very, very passionate about because it has a few facets to it. Basically, the rule of autonomy is when designing an automation system, and this is a really good tie into what we're going to talk about with StackStorm, it's really, really important to develop software or to use software. You don't, you know, not everybody has to be a developer for this, but to have a system of some kind that is autonomous. And the definition of that for me is a system that is able to make decisions, you know, even basic decisions on its own with minimal human input. It's able to react to situations without requiring a human to go in and say, yes, go do this. Yes, go do this. No, don't do that. Things like that. The rule of autonomy is essentially, you know, understanding that everything's a system, back to the first rule. So everything's a system. Instead of getting our input from a human being, always challenge that idea. Always ask yourself, you know, as you run a script or as you, you know, run a playbook or something like that, ask yourself, do I as a human being, am I really, really, truly needed to give this input? Or could this input come from some other system? A really practical example is when I was writing a script about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago to automatically put together a configuration for some sort of a fiber channel switch. I think it was a Cisco Nexus. And I found that it was actually actually fairly easy to extend that to pull its information from Cisco UCS instead of having me populate that information with like a spreadsheet or something like that. So being able to tie those two software systems together allows me to just simply step back and optimize it when needed. You know, I returned it to that script multiple times and changed it to make it more efficient, but I wasn't a crucial part of that chain. I wasn't we'll call it load bearing. You know, I wasn't an integral part of that workflow. I was just sort of the architect of it. I was able to see the whole thing as a system and optimize parts of it when needed. And that's really what the rule of autonomy is all about. It's about making sure that you always challenge that concept. Am I or any human being really, really necessary as the input for this part of a system? You sort of move up the system, removing yourself from more specific parts as you go up. And a really cool byproduct of that is you start to gain capabilities that you never had before, which is why, you know, automation, anybody that's really done automation in the real world, they realize that nothing is ever night and day. Everything's very incremental.
This goes very much into what I've been thinking about a while ago as well, comparing different automation scripts and solutions and all the different components that you kind of have within your organization or environment to software microservices, because they all kind of like tie together, provide APIs, have very structured and very should have, I should say probably, should have very structured, distinct kind of territories they operate in and very distinct, very structured input from like one to another to work together properly.
Yeah, that's an interesting corollary, I think. I mean, like, obviously, the way that microservices are typically viewed are, like, in a single app context, like, right, trying to deliver a single application. But the same concepts there, like making sure you have kind of like these isolated feature zones or whatever that a thing is addressing, is an interesting concept there. Like most tools and things that we use inside of data centers today, typically will have some way of interacting with it programmatically from a northbound as well as whatever it's configuring on the southbound. And so to your point, I mean, taking those things and kind of viewing them as an
a service.
Yeah, or a service, as you said earlier, that can be that can serve as not only just pushing information to have a certain state change, but also getting information from, speaks to what Matt was talking about, which is removing that human element, because the source of truth for that data is going to be that service or that tool that's actually doing that thing, right? And so if you can programmatically get that and bring it into whatever tool needs to utilize that data to make something else happen, that's better than having a human translate that. And so that's exactly kind of the heart of what Matt's getting at there.
So it's getting the data from the single source of truth, wherever that is, not from the human operator. It's not the automated remediation that, for example, Jeremy Stretch is talking about in his pyramid of network automation needs.
Well, it can be. I mean, like the thing is like that information can sometimes be, hey, some service or something in your data center isn't working optimally or nominally, and you can make decisions based on that. And we'll touch on some of that as we start talking about StackStorm, because it's kind of these premises that StackStorm was kind of built and designed and conceived from. And so it sometimes can be just simple as like, hey, an input might be I want some sort of configuration state to change because I need a new service or a new application inside of my data center. But it also could be something's not working nominally, so let's make some kind of decision based on that data. And so it doesn't have to just be kind of configuration state change, so to speak, to deploy a new service or whatever it might be. It could also be, as you spoke to earlier, the auto remediation, like, hey, something's not working optimally. Let's collect the data about that thing that's not working optimally and make a decision about that. If we can't, for some reason, make a decision, we don't have enough, the application that's making a decision on what to do might not be intelligent enough to take into account all certain kind of data points. And so if that's the case, then let's get a human involved.
Okay. So assuming we want to do that, you would probably solve this with StackStorm. So let's start with the basics. What is StackStorm?
So I'll give my like kind of elevator pitch for how I usually describe StackStorm from a technical level. Before we acquired them, and even now we still use it whenever we talk to people, StackStorm like to talk about themselves as the kind of if this then that of operations, right? And so if you've ever used if this then that, it's a website slash service that you can consume online that basically ties in a bunch of different online services together. And so basically you say, if my cell phone is connected to my home network, then, you know, tweet out to the world, hey, I'm home or something. That's a silly example, but an example nonetheless of how you could use if this and that. And the same concepts apply to StackStorm. StackStorm really is predicated on kind of three primitives, right? So we have sensors on one side, which are isolated pieces of code that are either polling or subscribing to some sort of API to get data, right? So that could be a Docker stream to see whenever new containers are created or a new network's created on the Docker ecosystem. It could be subscribing to Sensu message bus to see when certain monitors or alerts have been triggered, like for instance, too high CPU on a host or whatever. It could be a Nagios alert, whatever that might be. That's what a sensor would contain. It's either polling or subscribing to some sort of API to collect data. And then on the other end of the spectrum, You have actions, which are kind of atomic things that you can do within your infrastructure. And so that might be, you know, sending an API call into OpenStack to create a new instance, or it might be kicking off an Ansible playbook. We have some pretty deep Ansible integrations. And so those are kind of the two extremes, right? You've got sensors, which is collecting your data, and you've got actions on the other end, which is making some sort of change. And so what you do is you link those together with a rule. And that's where we get the if this, then that type comparison. A rule basically says, if a certain sensor is triggers, then do this action and or workflow. And so we have this on the action side that can either be some sort of like one single atomic thing, like, you know, turn on a interface on a switch. Or it can be do this workflow, which might be a complex chain of actions, like do this, and then if these conditions are met, then maybe branch to do another thing. That's a real kind of nebulous way of saying that, I realize, but there's also some nuance there, so it's kind of hard to put that in a concise little package. But a workflow is what we try and do with a workflow is capture the intelligence, so to speak, of an operator. Like, what is the decision chain that you would normally make under these scenarios? We try and capture that inside of a workflow. So it's kind of like a programmatic representation of a runbook. So like whenever an issue is seen in a data center, typically a NOC or a service tech will have a runbook, which is like step one, if this issue is seen, do this thing, which will be maybe collecting some data. And based on that data, branch off into other decision trees. And so workflow is a capturing of that runbook, so to speak.
Well, this was a lot. This was a lot.
Yeah. And I don't even think I breathed that whole time whenever I was saying that.
This would be like Cisco's embedded event manager, but for the whole system, not just for one device.
Yeah, I'm not super familiar with the event manager. I think I may have used it like once
yeah,
in my career.
Yeah, same. I will say I can think of probably quite a few differences, but the one difference that I'd probably highlight if I were forced to pick one is how extensible StackStorm is. And you know, when we get into the details, I can cover that for sure.
So how about those sensors? What type of things are supported for it to listen to? And can I write them myself? Can I plug stuff in? Or how does that work?
We have this concept of packs. And a pack is kind of a single integration bundle, so to speak. A pack can consist of, and just to like pick apart, for instance, like AWS. We have an AWS pack that will have several different actions for creating instances or creating different buckets in S3 or creating like a RDS instance, etc. And it'll also have like ways of polling that API to make sure an instance is in a certain state, right? Is this instance up? Is it terminated, etc.?
So you get the sensors and the actions in like one pack together?
Correct. So, it's not like a strict requirement. For instance, there are several packs that don't really have any sensors because it might just be a synchronous API call, like, hey, go do this thing. And it says, okay, I'm doing this thing. And that's really it. You don't have to go pull an API to make sure it happens or whatever. So it's not like there's a strict requirement on one or the other, but they are packaged together like that. So things like Sensu might have some certain actions you can take to add nodes, but it also might have like a sensor to go also subscribe to certain events inside of the Sensu infrastructure. Same with Nagios. You might have an action to go create a node to start monitoring it, but also a sensor to actually start polling that to see, okay, is this certain threshold met or not?
And it's really cool to have packs be that, you know, basic unit of distribution for these extensions, because then the user experience is so much more simple, right? Right. Like all I need to do is and there's a command for this in StackStorm where you can just simply install a pack. And so all of the capabilities for, you know, to your point, like AWS, for example, you would get all of those capabilities, you know, sort of in one go.
Right. Just from like typing in the command st2 pack install AWS.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just a nice user experience thing. You don't have to fuss with whether or not what you're trying to do is a sensor or a rule or anything. It's just all a pack.
But there's two sides of that coin too, right? Like we have integration packs that exist today, and there's quite a few of them, but that we obviously don't cover everything. There's no way. We're an open source project, so there are people committing stuff all the time. In fact, I think I saw somebody commit like a Microsoft Excel pack the other day so they can generate Excel sheets from,
oh my God,
from StackStorm.
Yeah, I've just seen that. There's an Excel file pack, yeah.
Right. And that's actually the most common way that we see people writing code for StackStorm. Aside from the core developers, we have a lot of people who write integration packs for us. And so there's two sides to that coin. There's the packs that we already have that we support out of the gate, and then there's the packs that you can write to form whatever integration you have internally in your infrastructure. So if you use something obscure, or maybe not something that's not obscure but just not integrated with yet, you can certainly, we have the flexibility, we have this framework set up by which you can create the integration yourself. And so that's all written in Python, and so you can basically say, like, okay, I want my sensor set up this way. And again, I mentioned two ways that it can be set up earlier. Polling, where it says every configurable amount of seconds, go ask this API and then analyze that data. Or it can be like what I call like a long living sensor, which is basically I want to subscribe to this message bus or I want to subscribe to an HTTP stream. And I just am continually consuming data and analyzing that and doing something with that.
Would those protocols have to be implemented in the particular sensor pack? Or if you want to subscribe to like a message stream or something like that?
Just to give a simple example, like if you wanted to subscribe to a RabbitMQ message bus, you would just put whatever library you're utilizing in the requirements.txt of that pack. And we do some interesting things in StackStorm to allow that both the sensors and the actions to run in kind of quote unquote isolation. So they have their own virtual environment with Python. And I know I get that I'm getting into a little bit of the kind of software weeds with this, so we can come back out of this immediately. But it has its own virtual environment that all that software is run in. So it has its own requirements that are installed into that virtual environment.
Speaking of virtual environments and software, so I set StackStorm up once before, trying to play with like the ChatOps part of it and everything. It's a beast, right? I mean, on top of the fact that you say it sets up certain things in virtual environments in itself, just setting up StackStorm in itself required like 15 different things that, you know, work together, integrate, et cetera, et cetera. I don't really have a question with this, but this is just really my complaint here.
We've had that feedback before, and so there's a couple of different ways that we try and mitigate that, especially for people who are just coming fresh onto it. You're right. The problem that we're trying to solve is kind of generic automation on either end. So whether it be the sensing or the action end, it's supposed to be relatively generic, which makes it powerful, but it also makes a certain level of complexity to it as well. A couple of different ways that we try and mitigate that, at least now. If you just want to get started with it, we have the Vagrant image, which sets everything up for you, including some of the ChatOps primitives. And then we also have like a single line installer that will install it on a production-ready version of it on a single device. So if you want to have like a scale-out device that has our services running on many different machines, obviously it will get more complex. But for a single instance, we have it pretty simple for you to install it now. If you want to install it, we do have the instructions on our documentation about how to install it kind of from scratch. Like if you want to actually get our Debian or RPM packages and install everything from scratch, which will require some configuration and some manipulation. One thing that I will credit our team with, though, is that we have a developer assigned to our Slack channel all the time, our community Slack channel. So if you've got a question, at least between normal working hours and Pacific time, there will be a core developer in the Slack channel that will help you out with whatever question you have. So I appreciate the feedback, which it's feedback we've certainly gotten before. And I'm not sure when you tried it in the past, but we've tried to mitigate that in a couple of different ways. So if you tried it again, I'd be curious if you still have the same critique. And if so, I'd be certainly interested in figuring out how we can make it easier for people to consume.
It's probably been a while. It's been like half a year ago or something. And I think I used the one-line installer type of thing, which wasn't really one line because there were a couple of other steps to take along the lines as well. And it makes perfect sense, you know, if you're actually trying to use this in a bigger environment, trying to like scale this out horizontally, it makes sense to have several different components that you can put different places, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it just seemed like, oh my God, I need all of this to like do this one simple thing.
Right. And you're right. In order to kind of meet the goals that StackStorm was set out to meet, there was this bar of complexity that we had to raise to a specific point in order to be able to meet the goals that we had. And so there is a lot to it that's going on. I'm hoping that your experience with the installation process now would be much more positive than it was, say, 6 months or a year ago. But we'll leave that up for the jury to decide.
Tell me more about sensors, because I'm still stuck on like the input side of things, and then we can talk about the output side of things. What else can I trigger things by?
Yeah, before we go there, a more generic question. Sorry to interrupt. StackStorm is like a generic platform, and you can plug any type of sensors in or data getters. And on the other hand, you can plug in any sort of output actions that do whatever. And what the platform really does is it provides the glue and the mechanism to create the workflows and the branching logic and all that.
Absolutely correct. Like what we provide you is the scheduling for these tasks. We provide you with a framework to build these integrations. And we provide you with a workflow language or DSL for you to describe what that operator intelligence or intent is. And so those are kind of the core things that StackStorm is providing you as a consumer of the product. So it's allowing you to, in a concise and scalable way. So it's like people would typically like try and accomplish this by like piecemealing scripts together. And so what we do is we give you like almost confines to work in, right? So we say like, here's the padded room you can go play in, build your sensor to these constraints, and then build your actions to these constraints, which allows you to further integrate that with other things as you move forward. So like in effect, you would say, I want to integrate with AWS. So instead of integrating, you know, 8 different software packages to go talk to your AWS integration, you would say, or instead of saying 8 different packages that need AWS, you're going to write the same Bodo code a million times. We would say, no, just consume the action inside of StackStorm, and then basically you've allowed that to be consumed by any other integration that's inside StackStorm at that point.
It sounds a little bit like Ansible on steroids.
Yeah, so the main thing that Ansible misses is the kind of scheduling piece. And it's like one of the main use cases for StackStorm is actually leveraging StackStorm as the scheduler for running Ansible playbooks. So.
For Ansible, right, yeah.
Right. So on the DSL for describing that intent, we support like 2 main types of ways of doing that. One of those is the Mistral DSL, which comes from OpenStack, and we're core contributors to that. And then the other side, there's Ansible. They both get very heavy play inside of StackStorm. So we see a lot of people that do stuff with Ansible, and we see a lot of people that do stuff with Mistral. So
I think Ansible also misses the sensor part of it, really, because it doesn't really have anything that would trigger. Yeah, well, you could call it scheduling too, I guess. Yeah.
And Elisa, you know, every part that Matt's been talking about is really extensible and pretty simply, actually. And so to your earlier question about sensors and how those actually work, it's actually fairly simple. When you want to define your own sensor, and again, all of this is done within the context of a pack, because again, that's the unit of extension in StackStorm. If you want to create your own sensor, you really only need 2 things. You need a YAML file, which the specification is all in the documentation. And basically that YAML file just describes your sensor to StackStorm. What is it that you're trying to do? Some metadata about it. And then alongside that, you provide a Python script. And that Python script, it basically leverages one of 2 potential Python base classes, depending on what you're trying to do with it. To your point earlier, the way that you would actually implement that is, let's say if you wanted to reach out to some sort of, you know, API, or let's say, you know, let's use some of the maybe network-centric examples. We wanted to reach out to an Arista switch. We would write a Python script that leverages, you know, PyEOS, or I can't remember, is that the name of the library? I'm pretty sure that's it. Yeah, so you would actually use that and import that into your Python script, do the work, all within the context of a class that inherits from one of 2 StackStorm base classes, specifically the sensor base class. Alternatively, if you wanted to write more of a passive sensor, so that's an active example. That's actively going out and sensing something, reaching out to the Arista API and asking it questions. If instead you wanted to do something like streaming analytics, something that was more of a passive, I want to watch this sort of all the time and receive some sort of a constant flow, you would just use a different base class in that Python file. And so that's what a sensor really is. Obviously you provide this within a pack because that's how you install those things into StackStorm. But a sensor really is nothing more than just those 2 files, a YAML metadata file that describes the sensor, and then a Python file which actually implements it.
And the only caution I would give there is Matt said the word simple a lot, and I would say that it is relatively simple.
Assuming, it can be.
Right. Building a pack assumes you have a certain level of knowledge of Python, right? Like it's not like printing Hello World. It's you're going to have a class that inherits from a base class, but I mean, we have examples of that. It's not, I guess what I'm saying is it's simple so long as you have the right fundamentals down.
Yeah. It will require a little bit of object-oriented knowledge with Python specifically. But if you're a Python programmer, it's just a simple matter of using those base classes, really.
Right. Yeah, I was wondering if it provides kind of built-in things. It could even go further. Like it could even, you know, provide, I don't know, a message queue listener, AMQP listener, or whatever, in some generic fashion that you could then utilize to do more specific things for whatever uses or, you know, sends AMQP messages. But I guess that part you would still have to do yourself. It's just the listening thing.
Assuming that integration doesn't exist, yeah, you would need to build that yourself. StackStorm is I feel like we were pretty clear as a team of what we're trying to build, right? Like, we don't want to answer the monitoring question because I feel like there are many tools you can pick from that do answer that well. Sensu, Nagios, you can go down the list. And we don't want to solve the like intelligence piece of the device, meaning we understand that there are certain domains that have specific knowledge of something. For instance, we're not going to recreate OpenStack. We're just going to integrate with OpenStack is a good example. Like, we don't need to know about instance management. We can just integrate with that API. So really what we want to do is we want to sit in the gap between those. And because, so if you look at, I gave a presentation at the OpenStack Summit in Barcelona a couple of weeks ago. What I basically distilled it down to is people typically have monitoring in their data center, and they typically have some sort of automation, whether it be Chef or Puppet or Ansible, whatever it is. But rarely do people really link those two things together. Rarely do they say, based on some monitoring event, we want to kick off something on the kind of automation side. And so the heart of what StackStorm's trying to do and the gap that it's trying to fill is that one, which is bringing the monitoring and sensing type functionality together with the go take an action based on that.
Right.
Yeah, and this was exactly what I was talking about with the rule of autonomy, right? You already have these systems in your data center, and we have for some time. Monitoring isn't new, and automation really isn't new either. We've done scripts and simple automation tools for a while. And what we always do in those scenarios is we are the human glue for those things. Mm-hmm. We always translate between those two systems because we have to. All of this is really all just about replacing that human translation with software, which is actually human logic at the end of the day anyway.
Right.
It's just more efficient and more reliable.
Right. Because, I mean, like, effectively, anytime you're running an infrastructure, whether you be troubleshooting and remediating or whether you be standing up new services, what are you doing? You're collecting data and taking action based on that data.
How about Jenkins in that context? I'm using Jenkins to, like, automate, you know, something triggers something, it does something.
Sure. Jenkins and StackStorm actually get compared, especially whenever we talk to folks about using StackStorm in a CI context, because we actually heavily use StackStorm ourselves in our own CI pipeline. And so that comparison gets drawn not infrequently. The simple way to say it is that StackStorm, from an automation perspective, is much more robust. Like, Jenkins was built to answer a specific problem. It's a similar type problem, but it was in a specific domain, whereas StackStorm was built to answer this generic domain of that type of automation. And so there, because of the design decisions that were made for Jenkins, because of its specific or narrow focus, it doesn't fit well into certain contexts. For instance, there's not, to my knowledge, a extensible and fully featured workflow language in Jenkins like there is in StackStorm. And so that would be kind of where the breakdown happens in Jenkins, where it would be like kind of like a on this thing, do this thing, which could be an Ansible playbook, but the
pipelines, I guess? No, what are they called? There's something like that in Jenkins.
Okay, well, that speaks to my ignorance on the Jenkins side then. But that comparison doesn't get made infrequently. But we've had quite a few people who have actually moved from automating stuff in Jenkins to working with StackStorm because they reached some sort of limitation that they didn't have on the StackStorm side.
I can see that because Jenkins is definitely tailored towards CI. And if I would want to do something more complicated with it or something that is, I don't know, not triggered by, you know, a Git check-in or whatever, exactly.
My experience with Jenkins, most of the time, if you want to do anything super complicated, it typically takes the form of a shell script, right? Where Jenkins is kept relatively dumb and the actual automation that takes place is some sort of a shell script that's in a repo. Things like, you know, integration testing, for instance.
And that's not to take anything away from Jenkins. Like, Jenkins answers the problem it was built to solve well.
Exactly.
StackStorm was trying to answer that a problem in a more generic way, rather.
Think of it like the best parts of Jenkins, which are sort of like the workflow automation, and then also say the best parts of Ansible, where they have this DSL that's not, you know, requiring you to know the crazy details of a scripting language. It sort of unifies those two ideas together and makes it more of a user-friendly pipeline.
I'm trying to think of something concrete. So, because I guess I get the components and I get what we have there now. How would you, I'm lacking some examples. Like, what are the use cases? What are like the cool things you can do with this?
This is one example of how Netflix uses this inside of their infrastructure. So I'm going to get this wrong. I can't remember if it's Kafka or Carafe, or it's one of those distributed key value stores. But in any case, they have a cluster of those running and they're monitoring those with some sort of monitoring service. And when they notice that, when one of the nodes actually goes into a failed or an unhealthy state, they will catch that notification and then they will spin up a new instance and have it join the cluster. The sensor on that side would be the monitoring of those nodes, and the action on that side would be, under these conditions, go spin up a new instance and join it to that cluster. Another concrete example of this is how Mirantis is using us in their one of their largest OpenStack deployments. So what they do is they monitor their Nova instances, and whenever a Nova instance goes into an unhealthy state, they will actually evacuate that server of all of its guests because, for instance, if it loses network connectivity or if it goes into a degraded state on the networking side or if it has too much CPU utilization, whatever it might be, they will basically migrate all of those guests away to a healthy server so that those guests can continue to serve whatever application they're serving. Those are kind of two use cases, but they're kind of similar in how they kind of react to different things. But that's how two people are using us in production today.
Just to add to that, when a software developer, you know, is writing a program, they find a bug in their program, or maybe a user reports a bug. The first thing that they do, or that they should do, is write a unit test that actually triggers that bug and tests for it. And then they go fix that bug to make sure that that unit test passes. And what they've done there is they've said, you know, I don't actually have to deal with this bug anymore because I'm testing for it automatically. And I think of StackStorm filling sort of a similar void, you know, that's just an analogy, obviously. Basically, if, it, you know, as operations people, we go through these things every day, you know, you get paged at 3 a.m., you get an email from the boss saying this thing's down, you need to figure out, you know, how to fix it. You know, go fix it, go deal with it, but then figure out, hey, you know, like, could I put something into place that does the same thing that I just did for me? Right? In this weird corner case that happens, this weird failure scenario that doesn't happen very often, could I anticipate that somehow with software and remediate it in the same way that I did? I think of this as sort of a similar case where you think of all that, you start to think of all those activities that you've performed over the past couple of years. You know, my few years in operations, I can think of a ton of things that I would have done using StackStorm or a similar software system just by going through those use cases. And I think you start to see some powerful use cases there.
But this is really the hard part, like coming up with the different like rules and workflows that you want to have to, you know, troubleshoot or find issues along the way. Because this is really something you develop over time. You know, you run into like this problem and that problem, and then you learn how to monitor for it in a sensible way.
And it's going to be different for every environment, right? Like different applications, different infrastructure setups will have different types of workflows that are needed based on the kind of business case.
Another basic question, as we are all networking engineers, how much networking support is in StackStorm or its specs today? What can you do for the networking engineers today?
I would have asked for more networking examples here next, yeah.
The support has been largely focused on Brocade right now for obvious reasons. Brocade owns StackStorm. And so the networking side of the house has been largely focused on that. There's some interest in Napalm support. So like basically an integration back for Napalm so that effectively you have actions that can then run against any supported Napalm device. The networking use cases, so like I built a demo not long after we acquired StackStorm, which basically tied the Docker HTTP stream into the kind of physical network. So this was not long before, it's been so long that I'm going to forget these names, but it was not long before IP, Mac VLAN and IP VLAN, that's it, for the lib network drivers for Docker. It was not long before those became like a de facto part of the Docker ecosystem. And so I was leveraging one of their pre-builds of that and basically subscribe to the HTTP stream. And whenever we saw a new network get created on the Docker side, we would instantiate that same network into the physical network side. And so basically what IPVLAN and MacVLAN do, if you're not familiar with that, is it allows you to effectively let Docker hosts connect to the network similarly to how a virtual machine would. They get their own interface onto a bridge, which is a bridge to the network, and so they can talk on a specific VLAN with their own MAC address and or IP address. At that point, you have to have some sort of linking between your container ecosystem and your physical network. Otherwise, those packets don't go anywhere, right? Like if they're trying to talk over VLAN 10 and the network doesn't have VLAN 10, well, those packets aren't going anywhere. Basically, we use StackStorm to subscribe via a sensor to the HTTP stream coming from Docker. And when we would see a new network on there, we would turn that around and create that network on the physical network. And so basically, you would use the Docker's UI, which is basically a command for creating a network, which would have some sort of trigger into having a physical network change based on that. A couple of different other networking examples, one of which is on our MLX side, and it actually leverages a new type pack that we're creating, which is expect, you know, because the MLX is largely exclusively a CLI device, and that's not necessarily uncommon for networking devices to be CLI only, at least in sort of existing deployments. So the expect runner will actually take in a set of commands and what to expect, and then using an EBNF parser, not to get too far into the weeds, but it's a kind of like regex. If regex was on steroids, this is what you would get with an EBNF parser. It's actually a nice way of parsing blobs of text. Leveraging those kind of two paradigms, expect and EBNF, we can have a pretty stable way of interacting with CLI devices. And so basically we have an MLX use case where basically we are taking in data from like a web portal type thing, and it will translate that into configuration for the MLX. And so what that's mainly focused on there is for IXPs. So whenever an internet exchange point has a new service or a new port that they need to turn up for a customer, they go in and do certain things on a web UI, which then triggers a change on the MLX on the actual physical network side.
How about, you mentioned Nagios for monitoring type of things. How about just straight up syslog? Can I just trigger something by syslog message?
Yeah. So again, I would go back to what I said earlier, which is like StackStorm knows its place in the world. It's not trying to solve the syslog monitoring problem. But what we do is we integrate with like an Elk stack, so like Elasticsearch and Logstash and Kibana. We don't really use the Kibana component in this case, but we basically monitor Elasticsearch for a configurable search term. And based on the rate or whatever you want to see in that, if it exists or if it exists once or if it exists when a certain time frame, however you configure that, we can trigger based on that.
Especially in Brocade land, I remember having a lot of things where it was like, oh, there's something in syslog and now I know something is broken.
And that's actually, as far as the network's concerned, not just in Brocade land, that's a pretty normal way of getting that information. Like I know some very large deployments that use syslog to trigger things like BGP state and stuff like that and do stuff based on that BGP state changing.
So one cool and optimistic thing about the networking support with StackStorm is the things that I've observed over the past 2 or 3 years, which are, you know, things like, well, you know, Lisa, you know, Napalm is a good example, right? Because these software projects, either the libraries that Napalm consumes or Napalm itself or any of the other things like NetMiko, for instance, the great thing about all of these software packages is that most of the hardcore networking logic and integration logic is actually inside those libraries. And this is one thing that I personally am going to focus on now that I'm on board at StackStorm, is it actually shouldn't be that difficult to create extensions that consume those things, because again, most of the logic is in those libraries. A great example is the Ansible module for Napalm. The Ansible module is fairly simple, and that's because Napalm has built an abstraction that requires as little information as possible, and you just simply pass it in. So any extension to StackStorm actually shouldn't be that difficult. It's just a matter of getting it done. It wouldn't be, oh, well, we need to have a huge meeting with all these vendors to make sure that we integrate properly. All of these libraries are already written, and they're in Python. And so from my perspective, it's not a too difficult mountain to climb.
That's pretty much exactly what I did. I was playing with the Ansible packs and the ChatOps thing to make that work. Yeah. And I know David did the same thing. He didn't want to use the Ansible side, though. He wanted to integrate Napalm directly and did that somehow via Invoke, I guess. So what? I don't know exactly what.
I can imagine like writing a sensor to leverage Napalm and query a whole set of switches on their BGP state. And then just sort of monitor that passively over time. And then, you know, you can set up a trigger within StackStorm to say, hey, when this particular parameter that these sensors are feeding in exceeds a certain threshold, activate this rule. The rule would say, hey, I have this trigger that I'm watching. It exceeded the threshold that I was told to watch for. So now I'm going to kick off this remediation action. So if you see, for instance, a huge dip in the number of BGP peers, you probably have a problem. You might want to kick off an action, at the very least an action that would notify people of it. Maybe you would also want to kick off some actions to try to automatically remediate that situation.
Or at least collect some data.
So I think, again, the really cool thing is that all of that logic is actually already built in those external libraries that StackStorm would simply use.
Matt, I know you have a hard stop in a few minutes. So let's walk back to the very basics. StackStorm is an open source project, right?
Correct.
StackStorm, the company, is the company working on this thing, and this company has been acquired by Brocade.
Correct.
And then you have the Brocade Workflow Composer.
Correct.
So what's the relationship between these three, four entities?
Yeah, that's a good question. So StackStorm as a company doesn't exist anymore, except in heart for the team that exists inside of Brocade. But we still use the StackStorm branding very heavily on the open source side of things. We believe that that's a brand that still has a lot of life in it, and I don't see any end to that branding in the near future. On the Brocade side, what we do is we take StackStorm, and on the product side, we add a couple of things to it. So there's some enterprise-type features that come along with BWC. So there's some LDAP integration support, RBAC integration with various different users and having different roles and stuff like that. And then we have a visualizer for the Mistral workflow language. So basically, there's a GUI that which you can take actions and work and build like a workflow chain based on that. So those are kind of the main pieces that predicate what you're getting with BWC. There's another component to the BWC side, which is what we call Automation Suites, which is a collection of services and packs. So, for instance, you might have an inventory service that couples with some packs on the StackStorm side. And those things work together to form some kind of network function. So the first one of those is an IP Fabric Automation Suite, which basically lets you take your unconfigured number of devices that are connected in a leaf spine type topology And we'll take those from kind of day zero through day in management of that. So the initial stand up, as well as adding additional switches to that as your network grows. And so there will obviously be more suites that come from that as time goes on. But that's kind of where that's kind of the genesis, so to speak, of BWC as a Brocade product. Those are the kind of features that come with it.
And StackStorm as such is open source and will remain free.
Absolutely. So Brocade, just to address the elephant in the room, Brocade gets a bad rap sometimes for the handling of Viata. And so not to touch on that necessarily in particular, but I think that we've since then have a pretty good track record of how we've handled open source from Open Daylight all the way down to how we're handling StackStorm now. I was on the team of people who kind of at least shared my opinion about StackStorm before we acquired them. And on the product management side, it was very important for me and Kurt Bales at the time when we were kind of talking about this. It was very important for us to make sure that StackStorm remained an open source project. And there's a bunch of people who are very personally committed to making that stay the case inside of Brocade. So I don't foresee an end to that in any time in the future. And we're still actively... I mean, if you go look, we're still actively writing code to the publicly available repo. That's how we develop all of our software. They're the only things that get developed kind of outside of that public domain are the enterprise type features that I was talking about earlier. And part of what I was talking about that is not even on our team. So we are still actively involved in the community, still staffing that Slack channel, and all of our commits that you see, all of our pull requests are available on GitHub. So
how about Broadcom now, though?
So that's interesting. And honestly, I don't know much there. Broadcom obviously has said, and for good reason, that they want to divest themselves of their the IP assets of Brocade. And how that plays out, we don't know yet. There's a lot of different ways that it could go. Most of them look very positive for us, but we just simply don't know what that looks like right now. You guys will probably hear at the same time I do where that goes.
Okay, and if by now I'm excited and I want to try this out, where should I start?
The best place to go is to just go to stackstorm.com. If you go there, there's a download link that will take you to our documentation, which gives you the single line installer. If you're familiar with Vagrant, we have on our GitHub page, there's a repo called ST2 Vagrant. ST2 basically stands for StackStorm, right? So it's like kind of ST squared StackStorm. And so if you go there, there's ST2 Vagrant, and you can clone that repo and just Vagrant up, and you will have a working instance of StackStorm whenever it finishes.
And if people want to get in touch with you too, two Matts, how can they do that?
If they are so deprived that they need to speak to us, they can find me on Twitter at Big M Stone. I tweet very infrequently and try and stay out of politics.
And I am also on Twitter as Mierdin, Mierdin, and I blog at keepingitclassless.net.
And we tried not to comment on the importance of latency, right?
Yes. No comment.
sorry, I think you're 300 milliseconds behind. I couldn't hear you.
And Elisa, where can people find you and what are you doing these days?
I'm still hacking away on tools for various people. And you can find me at @foolisa on Twitter, but I really don't Twitter a lot either.
And you do have a website that's pretty static because you have too much work anyway, right?
Right.
And I'm Ivan Paperniak, and you've been listening to Software Gone Wild, a podcast on everything software defined. And if you have any questions, there is an email, Elias, and I forgot what it is because no one is writing us, so I'll just post it together with the show notes so that you know how to reach us. Thank you, Matt and Matt.
Awesome. Thanks for
having us. Thank you, Elisa. It's been really wonderful, and I hope that you'll get a lot of downloads and user questions.